Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hope everybody's doing well today. I want to welcome everybody to the Unimpressed Podcast. I have the Mad Lad film guys here in studio today. We have Graham Ladd and Ethan Kaiser. I'm unimpressed. I didn't know these guys before I moved to Charleston because they do great work. Probably the biggest game in town. I don't know any other game in town for what they do, but yeah. Welcome to the Unimpressed Podcast.
Happy to be here, John.
Thank you, John.
No, thank you. It means a lot.
We got Huck Finn. He decided not to shave today. Mr. Huck.
Yep. No, keeping it El Natural. Just coming off a three-week bender of filming and festivals. Yeah. That's part of what we do. One of our divisions at Mad Lad Films is, you know, filming conferences, big events, music festivals, things like that. And we did CCMF in Myrtle Beach and BCMF Barefoot in Wildwood, New Jersey. And each one of those about 5-day event.
Wonder what CCMF means. That means Carolina Country Music Festival. And BCMF is?
Barefoot
Country Music Festival. Bang Productions had four acts at CCMF. Bob Durkin does a great job. How did you guys get hooked up with Bob and Carolina Country Music Festival people?
I think it started back in 2015, back when we were living in Pauly's. We would work with a guy named Brent. He ran the film company, and I freelanced at the time. So, yeah, basically, I reached out to him on Craigslist, of all things. And, yeah, he was looking for, like, cam ops. And, you know, then I worked it that year, and then Graham came the next year. And then since then, we started the company, and now we kind of like grown into it, and we've grown in the production side. We really delivered a lot of good content, and they loved what they saw, and Bob's loved what he saw. And yeah, we all kind of have this joint team effort to make this whole production team with the video happen. And yeah, we deliver the after movie, ticket experience videos, and all sorts of content for the festival.
When y'all film one of these festivals, what's the agenda?
You know. Balls to the wall. No, it you know, starts early, and we have it pretty well mapped out these days, but at the beginning, you know, because this is what, sixth year that we've done it, so you know, we have a good run of day now. But I mean, it's a full lineup. You know, you're getting acts at this stage working in, you know, the crowds, the sponsors, the ticket experience videos, drone footage. And so it's kind of this whole ever shifting agenda, you know. And and then you have like proposals that come up. You have you know, catching the guys from Shadow Warriors Project, Mark Geis and his team, jumping in off parachutes and landing, you know, on stage or by stage or on the beach. So it it's kind of a mad dash, but you know, that's what mad lads do.
Mad lads.
But yeah, to answer your question, it's like four different stages covered by five different cam ops over 4 days. So it's like there's a rough outline, but you gotta have to learn how to go with the flow, and you have to kind of like make sure everyone's in the right place at the right time.
We average, I guess, about 10 miles a day.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, everybody thinks those things are a lot of, you know, fun and games, but mm-hmm. if you're there working it, that it wears you out. Oh, I mean, I was worn out walking around, yeah. you know, from one end to the other, trying to, you know, chase four different acts. So yeah. I can imagine wrangling camera gear.
And through obstacles of drunk people.
Yeah,
it's really difficult sometimes.
I mean, we have to continually trade off, you know, gimbal hands, or else you'll have like one jack arm, you know, little noodle over here. But yeah. By the end of the day, I mean, yeah, it's exhausting. So, you know, we have a Mad Lad workout routine, and, you know, just to stay in shape, and because it is physically demanding, mentally, you know, demanding. But we've, have a lot of experience.
Workout routine. What is that all about?
Yeah. We have a PT test for interns.
So as we grow, in the Mad Lad brand, we're going to challenge, others, not just to be the best like camera ops, but also challenge them physically, personally, to hit goals. And we're trying to build more of a camaraderie and a team for life, not just in business.
Gotcha. So now, Ethan, tell me a little bit about, you're an Army brat?
Yeah, military. My dad was Navy. So okay. Not so, that background.
So growing up as a kid, were you always a creative kid?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, I'd say so. I started, with me and my brother, we were in Boy Scouts, so you learn like different aspects, in summer camps of discipline and whatnot. But at the same time, we took the cinematography merit badge and that got me into, filmmaking. And what we did every summer, we'd go on the summer trip camps and everyone gets so excited about the video. So we would all have the camera and we just film each other just having fun, and then we'd learn, take it back to like Windows Movie Maker at the time and just make little short cuts. I mean, this is like, when I was 8, 9 years old. So I'd say, I was always pretty creative, and I was blessed to have a family and friends that supported that lifestyle, and realize you can make money in this business, and it's challenging, it's fun, but it has its demands.
With Dad being a Navy guy, where did you get the creativity from?
That's a good question. I don't know, maybe my mom. She was always the fun one and the creative one. My dad's kind of more straight shooter, and I'd say, and then my brother was obviously a big part of that. We kind of cultivate each other's creativity. He kind of has
y'all feed off each other.
He has that writer's mind and kind of that brain, then I always kind of like took it, and we would just collaborate, and then we've been all of us working together, Graham included, and we started just really young and doing like little Lego stop motion videos and just learning how to take a picture every few seconds, and then that's like, okay, well, now he can walk. Where is he walking to? So now it becomes a story. So then you kind of learn like that creative, it feeds. So.
And how many different towns traveling around did you grow up in? Mimi's brother was a colonel in the Army, right? And then he has two sons, and they move every 1 to 2 years. And it's like innate. And even the one son who's out, he works for the national parks. They don't stay in an area more than 5 years at the most. So how many different towns did you have to go to growing up?
I was pretty blessed. I was pretty much two.
I was
born in Kentucky. Like the first 3-4 years of my life were there. Then we just moved. My dad got stationed in Millington, Tennessee, which is north of Memphis. So yeah, I pretty much grew up there from, like 7 years old to like high school. And then, pretty much I call that home.
One brother, so two boys growing up outside the Memphis area. What did you think you wanted to do in high school?
Obviously, like coming from the military background, and my brother went military, and my dad kind of wanted us to go military. It was just kind of like guided towards that direction.
Uh-huh.
And I almost did. I mean, I was looking at enlisting the Marine Corps as combat camera, and then the Army has a MOS, military occupant specialty. It's called 46 Romeo, which is combat camera, but it's more public affairs realm, so it's not as cool.
Yeah.
So it's basically you're filming like retirement ceremonies and stuff. So the Marines had like that legit combat camera. I was like, I'm gonna do this, I wanna do it, because I kind of patched together. I knew I wanted to do camera, but I knew I wanted to serve. And it ended up not working out, where I got an opportunity through another company at the time in high school to work for. So I've always had the respect, and I love, you know, the service end of that, and I respect anyone who's in the military, and you know, but I ended up not going that route.
So combat camera, do they still carry a gun?
They do, yeah. They say you shoot first in the way of, yeah.
You shoot rifle first.
Yeah, you shoot your rifle first. Yeah, but the problem with the Marine Corps combat cameras, they guarantee you an area of specialty, not like the actual job. So within the combat camera, you could have been like a marketing guy or like a website designer. It was like there was four different ones, and you had a 25% chance. So I'm not going to sign like a 6-year contract for a 25% chance that I'll get the job I want. It was a hard decision, but I mean.
And then you went to where? University of Texas?
So yeah, basically at Texas A&M.
Texas A&M, yeah.
So I still got the military experience through the ROTC program. But the good thing at A&M is you don't have to commit. So it's basically just a glorified Boy Scouts.
Gotcha.
And at the end of it, you can decide to enlist or go into the military. But for me, yeah, it was just I wanted, you know, to have the experience and have the discipline. I can make a bed really well.
Nice, nice. Do you make grounds bad?
I see you don't shave.
Yeah.
I've stayed with you guys in Airbnb. I didn't see too many beds made.
I made my bed.
You did? You made your bed, Craig?
Every morning.
I'm trying to send these stories up vertically, and we see where you guys finally meet. So, okay. Graham, you are from Pawleys Island, South Carolina, right?
Yep. Born in Columbia and raised up there first 8-9 years of my life, and then moved to Pawleys, where I grew up the remainder.
Were you always a creative? What were you going on? Are you the, like?
No, I was always an athlete.
Yeah.
You know, played all the different sports. You know, my favorite was probably baseball and golf, but played them all and enjoyed them all. But I was always the kid that, you know, hated going to bed, was always outside running around playing, you know, cowboys, Indians, fishing, then picked up surfing when I went to the beach. And yeah, I was just always a very avid adventurer.
I told you your bloodline is from Huckleberry Finn. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I've tested that. I've tried to build some life rafts and float down the river. Tried that.
Yeah.
That sums me up pretty well.
So you're running around barefooted?
Oh, all the time. All the time with hemp necklaces.
Did you think about being a creative mind and?
No, honestly, I didn't really know what I wanted to do in high school, and in fact, I only applied to one school, and that was Clemson, and that was the day before the deadline was approaching, and honestly, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I got a scholarship, so my parents were like, you know, you should probably go, and at that time, that's what everybody did. And so, you know, I literally scrolled through. I remember scrolling through all the majors, and I was like, well, I'm really good at science, and I'm really good at biology. I like animals. I could see myself being a vet, and that's how I chose. And that's a pretty stupid way to do things.
Now, did you finish Clemson?
I did, yeah, with honors from Clemson, and got into vet school, which is pretty tough. You know, there's only 26 schools in the country. So, of course, you know, with that background, it's chemistry, biochemistry, biology. Those are, like, your main focuses. So I spent a lot of time in the library. You know, I've always been very driven, and I knew to get into vet school, you know, you got to have the grades and pass the test, so... You know, I was pretty disciplined, but had fun on the weekends. When I got accepted, you know, it came time to sign all the papers and the loans. And I was like, you know, I'm not really sure if this is what I want to do. I decided to postpone it, you know, put it on the back burner for 6 months. And at the time I was working at Banfield, which is, you know, pet hospital and the Pet Smarts in Myrtle Beach at the time. I had worked at the emergency hospital in Greenville, the Greenville Zoo. And then I'd moved back to Pawleys at this time when I got accepted to get all my ducks in a row for vet school. And so I was like, well, shit, what am I going to do now? You know, it's like if I'm not going to be a vet, because I hadn't really thought about it, to be honest. I was kind of just going through the motions. And so I started thinking about it, and I ended up creating a mobile app. And this was, I guess, 2009, 2010.
How big was the app on the screen back then?
Oh, my God.
Was it a big app?
Yeah, huge.
Really?
Yeah, well, and the problem, the app was awesome. It was basically a town resource guide, and I was aggregating all this information, like, you know, drink specials, happy hours, live music, surf forecasts, like everything manually. But how I guess I kind of got started in the creative side was I was trying to sell advertising for the app. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would be like, all right, you know, do you want for $300 a year, you know, you get these banners places on the app. Do you want to? Sure. I was like, all right, send me your graphic. Well,
what's an app?
Yeah, that was what I was getting.
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, they were like, we don't have a graphic. Can you make one? So I was like, well, you know, being driven, I bought a MacBook and started teaching myself graphic design through Illustrator. Then I was starting the graphics, and pretty soon they were asking, you know, can you build a website? Well, yeah, I can do that. Shit, how do I do that? You know, YouTube University.
Yeah.
And, kind of just like a snowball effect. And then, you know, that kind of built into social media management where, you know, I was going out getting content, posting it through Life in Pi. That was the name of the app, Life in Pauly's Island. I just noticed that, hey, when I do video, it gets 10 times the reach, 10 times the engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And I started doing videos instead of photos. And that, I mean, I had about 35 clients at the time, and I do one video for each one of those every month. So within my first year, you know, I produced like 360 plus videos just the first year, like solo. Now, they aren't the quality that they are today, but what it did give me was, you know, using a marketing background, which I also became a user experience designer during that field as well, which is, I think, a huge advantage to what we do today from not only the film side, but also the business side. Just because I know what the businesses need, what's effective, and so our videos are not only just like, you need a video, here's your video, boom. We actually take the time to understand their business, get it branded correctly in the right light, strategized, and then what we do is create a more effective video that, you know, gets
well, that transition of the transition of shooting, right?
Mm.
Transition of shooting and editing, and right, and delivering.
Yeah.
Right. I think if you understand the front end, you know, it kind of gives you a lead on how to shoot things, right?
Yeah.
Because
you are
editing, and then you know how it's conveyed and so forth. So you kind of, well, a lot of people can't cross that, you know, because like when I started shooting stuff and never knew how to edit at all, right? And then realizing, hey, all right, I'm learning how to edit a little bit, right? Then I started shooting a little better.
Right.
You know what you get. Yeah, so there is a lot of people don't realize that. So if you're listening out there, there is a, you know, if you can do both ends of that from shooting to editing, I think it makes you a better storyteller.
100% reactive versus proactive. You know, if you take the time to think about, you know, the background and your intended audience and what you're, you know, needing them to do, and you take the time on the pre-production side to align all the ducks, it makes the filming easier and better, but you're shooting with intent as opposed to feeling like you have to capture everything and then try and post, you know, fix something together on the back end. So yeah, if you're thinking of video, always think of, you know, your end audience and what you want them to do and kind of work backwards. But I mean, I think
at the festival, it's for sure spray and pray.
It's spray
and pray. Now, Graham, you self-taught. You never had any formal training, right?
Yeah, all self-taught.
Now, Ethan, now you had some schooling. You took some classes at Texas A&M, right?
I was a telecommunications major, which means, yeah, not really.
Oh, okay.
My first class was like, this is Twitter. And it was like talking about, this is what social media is. I'm like, I'm paying God amounts of money to go to pay out-of-state tuition. And I don't know. I actually didn't end up finishing A&M. I went 2 years. And that's when I realized, you know, I got the experience I needed. But, yeah, I mean, there was no real formal training. It was all self-taught, YouTube, on-the-job experience.
Discovery, right? How do things look to you when you see, you know, you're trying to tell a story. How does that video look to you? What do you see? You know, what details do you see? Because a lot of times people don't have that ability to see that type of detail to really tell a real story. How do, what do you see visually?
Don't give away all our secrets.
No, I mean, it kind of comes down to what you preach a lot is the sensitivities, you know, just like growing up and just being like a normal everyday human where it's like, say, I'm listening to you talk. It's like when you go to edit, it's like if you're talking, at what point does a third party look over here? So it's like you have an action reaction. And the reaction, in my mind, is almost as important as the action because it's too. You only have half the story if you're just shooting that. So if you take that back to the editing room and you see like all these shots of just like all the action, you have no reaction. It's like a cause and effect, you know. And we learned that in some film studies class that I did take at A&M. And it's like the you have all the different like the Kirchhoff effect, I think, where it's like you use like I'll have to fact check this, but basically I think it's the reaction shot and how like that this old film back in the day created the whole editing style that it's known to be now.
So for like a conversation as I'm talking, transferring to him to see whether he's you know, receptive to what I'm saying and then cutting back like that mentality.
Now you've been on some traditional, I mean, industry shoots and so forth and worked on some major TV stuff and film stuff. And things I went on back in the day and seeing directors is like one shot, you know, master. One shot. All right, give me some reactions. Give me some reaction shot. Do you see that same style?
It's like, really, I think you can break it into scripted and unscripted work.
That's what
so it's like, when you do scripted stuff, you know, it's like very specific and it's storyboarded where it's like unscripted, like reality, documentary, you know, it's kind of more loose and you kind of have to be more in the moment, which is an art form in itself. But then there's a whole other art form of like crafting a shot and like lighting it and then getting the move. So you have, I think the big two, and then in those two, it breaks down into, you know, all the subgenres, and I guess it depends on.
Because, you know, like some of the, when y'all did the stuff in Nashville.
Yeah.
Like some of the shots coming up to a one-shot VO.
Yeah.
Getting that bite, you know, and then a swing over here to kind of show that action.
Yeah, and I guess it kind of just falls down into your resources too, you know. I mean, ideally, in any really situation, I would prefer to catch everything in one take, right? But if you, and so you have a wide master, but if you can afford to have two other cameramen on the tight, you know, getting the different angles and the reactions, that's how I would prefer to do it. You know, the people don't have to act.
You're prioritizing the talent and like the raw moment as it happens. But sometimes you can't do that, so you have to like think ahead. Again, going back to like, okay, I know you have to know what you need to edit. So it's like good cam ops, you know, and good directors and stuff all think of like the, how it's going to cut. And you kind of have to think as you shoot, it's like, all right, maybe you'll go from that and then we can cut away to this. So that way we can stitch these two clips together. And it's like a cut and glue paste thing. And it just gets really complicated. But the more you do it and the more experience you have, and if you're starting out, you know, you just have to do it. And that's how we learn, you know, it's like.
See, I want you guys, this is what I've been trying to pound in y'all's head, right? I've been trying to pound y'all's head. Y'all understand that very, very good. But I think there's a third genre. That's that social genre. You know, how do we mesh that? I don't think nobody's done it. I don't think anybody's figured it out.
Yeah.
Because it is sensitivity driven on social, right? So how do we create a new filming style that will be viral but still look like TV?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. And I think, you know, some of the comedians, you know, that do the skits, I think do it really well, you know, because they will do like fast, hard cuts, like to their best takes, or if they're going on a rant.
But if you show that, you show those cuts to Ethan, he's like, oh, shit, I can't do that. I'm not doing that.
You know, it's like you're saying, it's a third form. And I guess we're, you know, we just favor the...
No, I don't think it's favoring. I think it just hasn't been done properly yet.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, it's like you're onto something because it's like, I mean, I'll ask you a question. I mean, when you're on Facebook, like, what are the most viral videos you see? Are they shot, you know, on a phone, or are they shot, you know, with professional gear? And I don't know. What would you say?
Well, I think first thing is relatability. Yeah. If you think about relatability, what's going to relate to the masses?
Yeah.
And what's that little hook? It's like short, sweet, hook them, and then you got them, right? And then how you tell that story is, I don't think that has been done properly.
Right.
Well, and it's also a whole different platform and mentality because, you know, in my mind, and you know, you're the social media expert, so, you know, pitch in if you feel differently. I don't feel like, you know, people are necessarily going to the social media platforms to get fed longer form content. I feel like they're there to be entertained or have a laugh, or they have, like, you know, a 30-second on break or a minute on break. Yeah. And so,
or they're on the toilet.
Yeah, they're on the toilet. And what I think we enjoy more is, you know, the longer form and the cinematic, like, side. So it's like two different mentalities, because it's like, if you go to Netflix, you're already prepared to watch something for 15 to 30 minutes, where if you open up Instagram, you're probably on looking, have a short break, you're 1 to 3 minutes, man. So I think it's just two different, I don't know, mentalities. What do you think?
I mean, I think there's percentages of both, that I think it's just trying to figure it out, and I don't think nobody's really figured it out. I don't know. I think one day when you hit it and then you step and repeat and do it again, it's just like this thing I've been developing, my finding a perfect audience. I don't know where it came from. I just put this together by myself. So I made it in three steps, right? So first step, finding a perfect audience. And this is linear to life, could be linear to spiritual. I use it in social media, and that's how I'm going to convey this narrative. It, within this first step is environment, foundation, sensitivities. So you go in, and we didn't have this when we started dealing with Hawk. This is something I've developed since then. It's like, all right, understand your environment, understand what's going on there. If you're going to build the house, I saw it called the build the house. Let's assess what are the content elements within that environment, right? You shoot that content out there. We see how people respond. That gives you the first round of data. Then you continue to improve that content based on the data. That builds your, and then that's going to build your foundation, right? And you keep doubling down on the data, and that's going to take 30 to 90 days to build this foundation of a perfect audience. Then once the foundation is built, that creates a sensitivity, right, of what your business is and how you're going to bring in more people to build the house. Step one. Step two, it is tone and timing. Because you establish the tone from the environment, foundation, and sensitivities, establish that tone. So that's like, that's the tone is who it's going to appeal to. Then you create that lookalike audience, put that content out there after you've already developed it for 30 to 90 days. And you're going to bring in people that have a similar tone that you've already processed in one. Timing gives you the control of when you put the content out there based on the effort data you have.
Yeah.
And where those people is, that's step two. Then step three is emotions. And this is a quick run through, people. This is a quick run through is emotions and landscape. I've realized that with emotions, when people start responding to your content, you don't want to have a knee-jerk reaction. These are the micro fixes, half percentage fixes that you digest. But you, if you've done step one and step two right, it keeps you on that path. And you don't have these knee-jerk reactions that people do when you see these wild comments. Right, you just digest that information and keep going and keep using those small micro percentages to perfect content. And then the last thing is landscape. Landscape is understanding what the tendencies are of your platform, whether it's Facebook, TikTok, Snapchat. So I want you guys to do that for the film. I think y'all could do it.
Yeah.
For the content, you know, creative content. Y'all just finished Rutgers Reno, and it's just the two of you guys, and it aired on the Design Network, and y'all did a great job. Just two guys doing that, and I think that puts you on the scene at a major level. So I don't know, what do y'all, tell us a little bit about Rutgers Reno.
You know, it was supposed to be a shorter project and ended up just, you know, with the timing of COVID and all the shipping delays, ended up stretching to about 12, 13 months. But all in all, you know, the synopsis, Darius bought a house, a historical home, downtown Charleston. He renovated it. And, you know, through this show, it's kind of a home renovation show while the home's being, you know, completed. We take him on different outings around Charleston, really showcasing his favorite things and exploring, you know, cultural elements, taking him fishing, taking him to different farms, different restaurants, things like that. And so I think the finished project was a great success. Everyone loved it. We loved it. Mm-hmm. Darius and his team loved it. And doing really well on the design network. It's also, I think, streaming on Samsung TV Plus, right? Mm-hmm. And but yeah, no, through the whole process, I mean, you know, just learned a lot about, we'd always worked on shows, but this is the first one where we wrote, you know, film, produced, and edited everything in-house, start to finish. Mm-hmm. So we learned a lot, and ready to tackle some more, and we have some other bigger shows in the works as well.
It's Darius Rucker, major country music star. I think about, you know, technology, right? And you think about, you two guys pulled a series off for a very limited budget, right?
Yeah.
When I was pitching shows for television, average budget for a 30-minute show was $350K. An episode.
Per episode?
Per episode, right?
Yeah, we need your contact.
1 hour, $750.
Was
per
that,
episode.
Was that scripted or like reality? Or
reality.
Okay.
Reality, wow. TV.
So that's like not even like, yeah, sets and actors. Yeah. That's just straight reality.
Yeah. So put that in perspective of what you guys did. Y'all did what? How many episodes?
Six
episodes. Mm-hmm. I think that's mindset. It's kind of like the Tyler Perry thing. I went and saw Tyler Perry. Tyler Perry's like, he said he would always sit in his trailer and be like, why is this taking so long? Why is this taking so long? And that's why Tyler Perry makes movies in like, you know, 15 to 30 day turns.
Absolutely.
Right? Compared to 90 day turns.
Yeah.
Right?
He stresses out a lot of actors because they know they only have like one or two takes too.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. Well, I think a lot of that comes down to like resources, you know? It's like that was, I mean, how long ago was that?
9 years ago?
Yeah. That's not
so long. But I don't know.
But in the technology side of things, like camera, and I think this is kind of where the whole industry is shifting right now, especially in the film world, is like between 2012 and 2013, that's right when like the DSLR boom kind of came out. So now these cameras got smaller, they became accessible
and affordable.
So it's like you got this kind of, you know, full frame look, if you will, shooting video, and then that kind of boomed YouTube, and then that boomed like tutorial videos where we learn and people post their films, and these films start winning awards and festivals, and then the technology keeps, you know, developing. So it's like the cameras get smaller, they get cheaper, so we were able to produce a show for a little less, and it's smaller, cheaper, more mobile. So it's like I think the whole industry is shifting in a good way, in the sense that, yeah, like maybe budgets are getting smaller, but at the end of the day, it's like more people can be creative because of those innovations and stuff. So I don't know, and that's where it's like even all my friends in the you know, traditional film community are all, the unions are kind of like figuring out, like, because all these streaming platforms are kind of restructuring their like rates and budgets and everything. And again, we just learned a lot just with this one network, but you know, I feel like a lot of networks are kind of just shifting. I'm not necessarily getting cheaper, but you know, there's more hungry like people, and it's the new generation of filmmakers, and you know.
But there's also a lot of waste in the film industry.
There is, yeah, a lot of inefficiencies.
Yeah,
that
fractions. That goes back to finding my perfect audience. That's me flushing out these fractions of business that are wasting people's money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
I mean, in my mind, like for a reality show, you know, limited budget, but let's say somewhat healthy, you know, in my world, I think we could pull off a, you know, $750,000 look with a 7 to 10 man team.
You already did it for less. You already did it.
And
I mean,
with, you know, five.
Well, and just my the experience, you know, just working with Travel Channel, History Channel, like they're shooting reality shows, and there's like three PAs just sitting around. And, you know, they're getting paid X amount of dollars a day, and then they're just kind of hanging out. And I guess I don't know why they necessarily need them, but it's just for extra help. But then that's extra cars you have to travel with. That's extra people you got to feed.
Extra lodging.
And I'm like, we can kind of pack this down instead of like, okay, you just be one focus. It's like we kind of are taking a different approach where it's like everyone's kind of multi-tool in a way on set, where it's like, okay, you just know a little bit about audio, a little like mostly camera, and if you kind of know, like you can kind of help each other out, and then you can kind of pack out those people, which, you know, you're more mobile, you're faster, cheaper, and I don't know, we're just trying to figure out like a whole way to restructure it in a healthy way, or, where we're not undercutting the industry.
Well, in a way, in 2004, when I started doing music videos, I bought a Canon XL1, and I just started shooting. When I looked at doing these music videos, we'd spend $50,000. I wouldn't make shit, but I paid all these people, pay like 30 people to do a music video, and I would get pissed off at the job they did.
Right.
So I started teaching myself every position.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I taught myself how to do everything, that's how I was able to build Bang into what it is today.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of the same principle that you're just in a different time frame, but that was kind of my thought process back then. But now it's more like, where do we go? What do we do? And I think distribution, I think that's where the kind of the Wild West is, because really nobody's understanding where to distribute their content right now because of guys like you able to produce a show at a very high quality at a very low cost.
But it kind of, I think it kind of goes back to just that military style where it's like, you know, you learn first aid and basic training, you learn, you know, how to use a gun, you know, you learn how to, you know, work as a team. And I think it's just building that, those skills is only just going to make them better, you know, as we cultivate this team. And I think, yeah, it's just eliminating those inefficiencies.
Yeah. But it's like, if you can get, you know, to the same look, but, you know, the multi-tool team can get there at a fourth of the price and still be happy and be treated fairly versus the 30-man team that takes, you know, four times as much for the same look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that speaks for itself.
It's like when I got into comedy, I didn't know the rules of comedy. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's probably good y'all didn't know the rules of doing this yourself traditionally.
Well, it's like, I knew the rules. I'm like, you can't do that. Like, it's like, but at the end of the day, it's like, it kind of worked. And then it's like, all right, now I have to rethink of how I was, you know, just trained in my environment.
Yeah.
Just growing in the production world where it's like, yeah, don't touch the audio guy shit. You know, like, you just don't talk direct. Don't talk to talent. You're a camera guy. Don't speak.
Yeah.
But that, and that so brings up a whole nother thing.
Yeah.
Because, all right, and you can, you know, you can ask any talent and, you know, people on set. What ends up happening, you know, with Mad Lad Films is because we have a smaller team, it's a more intimate setting and we build relationships with everyone who's involved with the process, which ultimately makes the talent feel more comfortable. And, you know, it's really interesting because at the end of our projects, you know, we've now formed friendships and partnerships, and that's a big part of, like, our, you know, marketing, I guess, technique, because we've actually never spent a dime on marketing. So not only does that, like, work for us, but it's better for the talent because, I mean, if you have 30 people watching you do something or five, what's going to be better for them?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most people are going to like and be able to, you know, feel more comfortable just with less people, you know, and it's like, all right, they know each five of those people's names, so they're able to perform better or feel more comfortable, which then relates to them being more authentic, saying more things that they probably wouldn't have come across with 30 people watching. You know what I mean?
It's funny. Just something like an on-camera interview. It's like, you know, you see us in frame, but then there's like the audio guy, PA1, PA2, assistant camera, director,
headset,
producer, and everyone's just eyeballing you. And as a human, you kind of just know like you're being watched by all these eyeballs, and then they stiff up. You know, you've seen it everywhere. And I think, yeah, it's just kind of part of that technique.
Well, that started like with the damn cameras that got the one shot, right?
Yeah. You
had to have 85 people looking at it to make sure they didn't miss anything because they had one shot at it, right?
Uh-huh.
So I think they need to improve that. I think understanding your story and then understanding my story, right? And you see these rubs, right? I think when you look at distribution, you know, even streaming, I think for people to take, if it takes five steps to get to content compared to two steps, and that's two steps picking up your phone and you find the platform, I don't think it's all finding the perfect way to tell a story with that content to make it go viral at a high level. I think there needs to be a little bit of adjustment in the tech world with their algorithm and how that responds to this better content, and then a little bit of change over here with creative. Because eventually, everybody's going to want to be in that two-step process to find content they want to view. People are too lazy to get through five steps, to go through an app.
Yeah.
You know, pick up your phone, go through the app, log in, right?
Yeah.
Then this, you know, I think that's where the world's going. So I think there's, if the tech world would understand Ethan's mind from a creative standpoint, and then creatives like you understand the tech world a little more, I think that's the future.
But I think one of the biggest disconnects between you and us is that, like you said it just then, you're trying to create the viral content, which we're not necessarily trying to do.
You're trying to tell more of a story.
A story that, you know, is more polished and intimate. And like, you know, and of course we've done stuff strictly for social media where, you know, if we're geared toward that way. But I guess our philosophy is like, you know, if you're going for 1 million views, you know, you have that view and then it's on to the next thing. Where, say, we only have 100,000 views, but they watched it for all 3 minutes, all 5 minutes, whatever.
Retention could be longer. Believe it or not, I think it's a different personality.
I think so, too.
I think there's a personality that opens up Facebook. I think there's a personality that opens up Instagram. Mm-hmm. There's a personality that opens up Twitter. Because if you put all those platforms together and look how people comment,
yeah,
they're different.
Yeah, that's
a different sensitivity.
And that's where it's like, you know, depending on, and maybe that's something that we need to explore, is, you know, custom creating content for a platform based on, you know, sensitivities. You know, in my mind, like the Facebook or Meta, excuse me, is definitely, I think people still primarily use it for like family and like family news. You know, yes, they see stuff from businesses and stuff, but I think primarily they're using it for to stay up with their friends and family. Instagram is, in my mind, more about entertainment and like showboating,
yeah,
for lack of a better word. You know, oh, I'm in Tulum or, you know, whatever. Yeah. YouTube is, I think, still entertainment and how-to, you know, to a large degree.
Yeah, it seems like YouTube's become more educational.
Yeah, more educational almost. Netflix, again, is primarily documentaries and shows and series. So there's like your, I'm there to, you know, check out before I go to bed, you know, that type thing. But I don't know. So
what was TikTok? What would you say TikTok?
TikTok's dancing, man.
I call TikTok a cheap trick.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's a facade for kids, you know, in a way. And I think they pick and choose. It's like Avery's like, I got to get it going on TikTok, mm-hmm. TikTok. I think they pick and choose who they want to, if they, you know, if the 10 board members see a song and those 10 board members like that, because there's so many bots on TikTok,
yeah,
I think they pick and choose who they want to go viral. So there's some girl like Charlie somebody on there is like got the most followers on TikTok, and she's got like 150 million followers. Wow. You really think, and if you saw her content, it's not that great.
Yeah.
You know, it's just her. I'm like, how do you get 150 million followers? Somebody's got to have you back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
If the content isn't extraordinary, right, or, you know.
She's not teaching anybody nothing. She's just kicking her leg up in the air. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, is she hot, though? She's really hot.
She's cute.
She's cute.
Oh, she's a kid?
She's 18.
Oh, God.
Cut the strike out of America.
Yeah, she's 18. I guess she came to poster child, and that's why I started thinking that TikTok picks and chooses who they want.
Yeah.
So if you can find that person at TikTok, you need to pick and choose that person. I mean, Walker Hayes, maybe he paid somebody.
Yeah, what does Walker Hayes have?
Well, Walker Hayes is, you know, he'd been in country music for forever. I think he's in his 40s.
Yeah.
Right? And all of a sudden, his daughter put that song out.
Yeah.
But I think they picked that song out and blew him up in a way. I don't think it naturally happened.
All it takes is one these days.
That situation, the Walker Hayes situation, created that mindset to an Avery Robertson, right? I got to figure out how to, you know, get my song out there. I don't think it matters. I think they just got to, you know, if they see it and they like it, they're going to blow you up.
Yeah.
If they don't see it. Now, I think other platforms are different.
Yeah.
I do think that Facebook or Meta's process and how they make things go viral is very, strategic and has steps to it, right? And if you understand those steps, you got a better chance of making things go viral. There's more brick and mortar a situation to get a video to really be seen by a lot of people.
I agree with that.
Because I keep perfecting our process, and our viral content just gets better and better.
Yeah.
You know, from like, we went from a vertical, you know, vertical was hot for a minute, right? Then full screen was hot. Now they've determined that 4x5s, you know, these 4x5 sizes are the best size because it fits perfectly in your phone.
That's what I was trying to get. Is like, I'm curious where, like, yeah, all this, the format's going to change. Because that, in our world, that changes the way we shoot. Because now it's like you got to kind of either shift how someone's framed in a shot.
Yeah.
Versus,
yeah.
you know, if it's widescreen. So it's like that changes, like, our job directly. So it's like interesting to know, yeah, where it's getting delivered. That's really interesting.
Well, luckily we can still film 4K and then crop it.
So I don't know. You know, if we could, here's the rub for me. Like, I want to, every piece of content, I want to layer through everything. So y'all shoot most stuff 16:9. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, you know, it's hard to get that 16:9 in a 4:5 and not lose anything.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
yeah, for sure.
So that's something to figure out.
Yeah.
You know, unless you just want to be focused on this platform, it does this size and so forth. I don't know. These are just pieces of the puzzle I'm trying to figure out. And I'm probably fast tracking this too much. I mean, there's probably still a lot of bandwidth to tell these great stories, and there's people want to consume this content. But, you know, if industry doesn't start catering a little more to the side of the social world, I think they're going to get left behind. I think that's where the struggle is, because industry is holding back the reins still. Right. Yeah. All the big money is still in mainstream, you know, because the old school mindset is there's too many variables.
Yeah.
There's too many variables in social, but finding a perfect audience, this is where I took the variables out. Like, this finding a perfect audience would change everything.
Yeah.
Would change everything, because I'm showing you the steps and I'm taking out these variables. So I think when you see you follow the money, this is when I think what y'all do is great. But when you see that bigger money starting to move to social, because that's where all the eyeballs are, then I think that's when these major production companies really got to start changing their mindset.
Well, and then something like you talked about, and what we're really interested in is how do you take like a great story that traditionally might be like an hour, you know, documentary, and publish it to a social media platform, and you know, get the eyeballs, but also it's like, you know, it starts to say, do you put it out there as an hour, or do you put out, you know, what, 6 10-minute clips or 12 5-minute clips, you know, as a series, as a mini doc series, just because the attention spans, you know, are longer or shorter on social.
The king of 1-hour movies, because people don't want to watch a movie past an hour. I think if somebody grasped hold of that, y'all could be the kings of 1-hour movies and the kings of 30-minute documentaries, right?
Yeah.
Then your docuseries are 3 to 5 minutes.
Yeah. I like that.
Then you can break down more, you know, if you want to market it for your 1-minute pieces and so forth.
Yeah.
But I think documentaries could be 30 minutes.
Yeah. You know, with the amount of views and traffic on social platforms, that, you know, you're going to see more and more series shows kind of, you know, be launched on that, which is something where it's.
And I think that's going to change the way it's edited too, because it's almost like, you know, you sit down for Netflix, you have that mentality, oh, I'm going to watch this, and it has a nice soft opening of like, oh, credits. But with social media, like, you got to hook them. So it's like, I think that changes the way, like, having that hook, and then it kind of, I think Goalcast is actually a good little mini doc page to like kind of take an example from it. Like, they hook you, and I was just scrolling, like, you know, just in my bed or something, and it was like the first 30 seconds, like, oh, this looks cool. And I didn't realize I've been watching this thing for 10 minutes. It was a 15-minute like mini documentary cut vertically, and it was like really well produced, really well edited. And I think that kind of speaks for something. It had like several million views, and it's kind of like you're earning their attention with that cut, in a way, where it's like you grab them, like you keep saying,
and then you've
earned their like attention, you've proven it, and then you kind of, now you can dip in the story, you can kind of have those slower moments, then you just keep building. So
because
I don't know,
at the end of the day, there's slower moments, and like the attention to detail is actually, in my opinion, what pulls you into the story, you know, and it's not just all entertainment, you know, it is actually the crickets in the background, the nice landscape shots that, you know, traditionally, like in today's world, that's not going to hook somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But in my opinion, that's what helps form the emotion, emotional attachment they have to the video or the film.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with, you know, the sensitivities, like here, sight, you know, you can't smell video, so you got to think of me.
Well, I don't know. I'd say you can't even hear it a lot of times because they say like 40% of, I don't know, you actually might know, like there is Facebook videos are muted. So that's why they're doing closed captions all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or subtitles. So I don't know. I mean, I remember reading somewhere is like, 30 or 40% of like people scrolling through at least Facebook watch or whatever is muted. So,
yeah.
So I don't know. I think now you're losing a whole sense. So it's like you got to visually capture it too. Yeah. I don't know. Which changes our jobs, like how it edits and then what you see first.
Used to on Facebook, anything with a cold open or script at the beginning slowed down the reach of the videos. But now they're going back to they want a little short little pop of what this is, you know. So if it relates to you and you go back to the captions, if it, you know, they're trying to say, they may not click on that video because everybody does like this, but to that caption, they're going to catch a percentage of the personalities out there that's going to appeal to their senses, right? And that's the reason they do it because there's a big, I guess it was probably 30, 40% of the marketplace will watch a video based on what they see just in captions. There's certain personalities that will click on certain things, whether it's captions, whether it's visual, whether it's what, you know, what the guy looks like
or the content itself.
The content itself. So what's the future for Mad Lad and what do y'all want to do the next 3 years?
Honestly, we just want to grow a team, and we have a bunch of team members right now that, you know, we're looking to bring on in a more full-time perspective. But, you know, we've learned early on, you're only as great as your team. And just like we were saying earlier with Rutgers Reno, you know, we had a great team of our friends that are super professional and talented. You know, Jansen Doyle, Thomas Runyon, Julie Jackson, Jimmy Rojas. Yep. And, you know, you're only as powerful as your team. And
so, we're working on, the future is just, getting people on full time.
Just think,
you know,
if we could take this, if we could take this three right here and duplicate ourselves multiple times.
But that's hard. And it's like trying to train an artist and also a scientist at the same time. Because it's a balance of the art and the science and the business.
Yeah.
So it's like you're trying to combine all these people and teach somebody this, where it's like it's trying to teach someone to be a Picasso. It's like you kind of either get it or you don't. Sometimes you can really formulate it, you know,
but it comes down to
hands-on work experience,
ethic, honestly, drive. If you have work ethic and drive, then you know, and that's what we've noticed. And those are the people that, you know, we flock to and they flock to us, you know, just because, you know,
you don't find too many guys 25 like Ethan that works as hard as he does.
Yeah.
Most people are. I was partying at 25, so it's very hard to find even a guy at that age to work that hard.
Yeah.
So you got lucky, probably.
I mean, we work just...
Yeah, man.
I know. Yeah. I know you work your ass off, but to find two people that can complement each other, that's a big deal.
Yeah, that's what we resonated, and we became friends first, and then, we started working together and then just became business partners, and it's an awesome partnership.
And, what's our saying? Closer than
more than a brother, less than a wife.
Pretty much.
And, man. Yeah, it's like you learn to share, like appreciate people like that in your life, and that push yourself, push others, and really inspire and motivate. Yeah, your team behind you.
Yeah, and as far as the future, just we're working on an action sequence commercial for Mad Lab Films. It's a passion project that we've been wanting to do for a while, you know, with boat chases, motorcycle chase, jumping off high elevations, some gun and fight sequences built in, because honestly, we haven't been able to really do what we're good at yet. And
we really haven't shown a side to our business that I think we were ready to show, so stay tuned for that.
Well, I will say this. I think y'all, you know, is like... back in the day, we brought storytelling to action sports.
Yeah.
In a way, y'all brought your narrative. Y'all kept your narrative with each client, whether it be entertaining, whether it be marketing a company or a lawyer company, whether it be any type of business or somebody you've worked with. You've kind of kept y'all's narrative the same with each client.
Yeah.
And multiple genres of clients.
Yeah, and I mean, we've just in the, 3-4 years that we started working together, I mean, we've produced thousands of different videos, but, you know, with his background, my background. Really, we've done in every type of content out there, you know, whether it's restaurants, commercials, you know, social content, you know, lawn business, television shows, feature films. So we've have a, you know, vast experience in all those. And now we're, you know, again, toning it down and really, you know, we want to concentrate this probably next 3 years into three divisions where it's like, you know, commercials, series and feature films would be one division. The second division being events, you know, that's covering music festivals, tech conferences, big productions like that. And then the third side being, you know, marketing videos for businesses where, you know, that is, you know, quote unquote, probably the least interesting, but it's what we're really, really good at because I think what we're able to do there is help business owners get excited about their business again. And then that translates in the videos that we do. And they get excited
about it.
And it
just gives
them
a voice and adds weight to like a person because you can tell they get more confident too. Like when they just around the environment and they see the product and they get excited about it. And I don't know, that makes us excited too. Just,
yeah.
You know, cause we're blessed in this world of having the ability as storytellers to give people a voice.
Yeah.
I think that's really important and, you know, using it for good. And even in business videos, it's like, you know, that's what it comes down to. It's like trying to figure out those stories and how to tell them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a blessing and a curse because the marketing videos we do are pretty much, they're so good, they're evergreen. So, you know, while people do, you know, come back to us several times a year, it's, you know, I'm hoping some of them will start to understand. It's like, all right, that worked. Let's start a residual plan, you know, of content generation and not, oh, let's use this one piece of content for a year. You know, you really got to, especially this day and age, keep getting your content out there. But, you know, it's really effective for them and it's fun for us, fun for, you know, to help people in small businesses and not just small businesses, but businesses in general. But I have an affinity for small business owners because that's the backbone, you know, of America. And so helping them succeed is, you know, part of what we enjoy.
Oh, cool. Well, I appreciate you guys coming on. And
thanks for having us. Yeah, thanks for having us. It means a lot.
Yeah, and telling a story. It's a good story, good conversation. I think people could learn from this conversation, you know, and relate. You know, my thing is trying to help people relate to life, you know, these micro moments. If there's someone out there that's your age or Ethan's age and they want to get in this business, maybe there's parts of this that people could listen to and say, hey, I can do this. I can do that.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? I don't think there's no limitations.
I mean, half the battle's just going after it.
Mindset.
You know, you learn more from failure than you do success. Yeah. That's for sure.
So Mad Lad Films, great guys. They do great work. You can check them out at madladfilms.com. They do good stuff, and they're here in my area in Charleston, South Carolina. Or their area, because they were here before me. But yeah, we got Graham Ladd, Ethan Kaiser.
Yep, nailed it.
And John Cosma.
And I'm John Edmonds Cosma, the CEO of Bang Productions. Thanks, guys. Appreciate
it. Awesome, man.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.